ABSC News presents The Defense Britons.
This features the second half of a two-part segment examining possible effects of a ballistic missile shield upon the behavior and interaction of countries. This segment, part two, will concentrate upon the Russian Federation, the countries of Europe, Japan, and Canada. In addition to destabilizing international weapons treaties, ballistic missile defenses, both a national missile defense system and a theater or regional missile defense system, will have a dynamic impact upon the realm of international relations. While international treaties could be seen as a rather indirect or formal method of countries interacting, specific responses to changes upon the global scene are far more direct and reflective of a nation's perception of a development. The actual reaction of a nation-state to the implementation of a ballistic missile shield is as equally important as ballistic missile defense implementation's effect upon international agreements and strictures. Alistair Millar, Vice President of the Fourth Freedom Forum, summarizes Japan's perspective of ballistic missile defenses.
We've seen from previous experience that the Japanese sort of divided and almost have two minds about this issue, in that the defense establishment in particular feel that they want to rely and need to rely on the security of the United States, which allows them in times of severe financial duress, as we're seeing at the moment, to focus their resources on economic and domestic issues rather than those of military issues. So it is a very, very important issue for them, and their proximity to China, Taiwan, Korea makes them a very important player, and I think Japan has more leverage than the United States often gives them credit for or takes into account, and they could in fact really cause some problems for the United States if they wanted to.
Leon Siegel, director of the Social Science Research Council's Northeast Asia Security Project, analyzes the effect of Japan's new right-wing prime ministership upon Japan's attitude towards ballistic missile defenses.
It's important to understand that Japanese nationalism on the right takes a very different form. It doesn't take a form of cooperating with the United States. It takes the form of lessening cooperation with the United States. Now, Koizumi is an ambiguous figure. In fact, his father was rather sympathetic to the United States, was an important, considers his vote on the security treaty back in 60 to be an important thing in his life. Koizumi is an ambiguous figure, but he's clearly played to the right wing of the party, which is on the rise. And it's personified by the governor of Tokyo, who is very right-wing and may well split the ruling party between the right and the moderates. So Koizumi has been playing this delicate line of trying to appease the right in Japan. The right's view, right-wing view, is, for instance, on the famous Article 9 in the Constitution, which says Japan may not have what it now even has, which is self-defense forces, spends the second, has the second largest defense budget in the world, is a quite potent power, doesn't have a lot of ability to project its forces, but certainly in terms of being able to guard the sea lanes, do a lot of things. The Japanese has a very powerful military force. For the right, what Article 9 meant is it was the thing imposed on Japan by the Americans to keep it from being a, what they call a normal country, meaning do whatever it wants in defense. So for the right, Article 9 is a litmus test of breaking or loosening the alliance ties with America. And missile defense, I mean, the way the current government in Japan has talked about missile defense is, you know, at one point the defense minister said, you know, if the North Koreans fire a missile at us, we'll develop our own missiles. He didn't say anything about missile defense. In other words, the nationalist, the sort of right-wing nationalist view, and be careful here, this is not World War II. We're not talking about anything like that. We're just talking about, you know, a generation that really didn't live through the war or live through the post-war, which feels that, you know, Japan is... all political tendencies are coming back. They don't want to go to war with people, but they do have a different view of the relationship with the United States. And it's not... It is not one like the view of those who, you know, signed the security treaty with the United States. It is one that wants to loosen the ties. It's very important to understand that we're watching a political shift in Japan. How far it goes, hard to tell.
Given that the Russian Federation, together with the United States, own approximately 95% of the globe's nuclear devices, and that much of the International Arms Agreement's framework depends on the stability of the treaty framework between Russia and the United States, it is important to examine how Russia may react to American unilateralism in the realm of anti-ballistic missile systems. Andrew Kuchins, director of the Russian and Eurasian Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, explains the current Russian position on the matter of ballistic missile defenses.
I think that the Russians have indicated implicitly and almost explicitly in recent months that they are interested in trying to renegotiate a new strategic framework. Now, I emphasize the word negotiate because they would like to see that whatever, you know, if the ABM treaty is modified or the ABM treaty is replaced, that in effect it is replaced with some kind of negotiated agreement. Now, the Bush administration has made fairly clear that they're not really interested in a negotiated agreement with the Russians. I think along the lines of the START agreements, the arms reductions agreements of the past, and even the ABM agreement. So I'm not quite sure how. I'm fairly skeptical that the Russians and the Americans are going to be able to reach an agreement about a quote unquote, you know, new strategic framework in the timetable that the Bush administration wants, and that timetable is very, very ambitious. That's really this fall. You know, with the meeting that President Bush and President Putin are supposed to meet in Shanghai for the APEC meeting in October. And then, of course, there's the summit, which has not, I think, formally been scheduled, but they're looking at in November. So November is the timetable that the Bush administration wants to be able to come to some kind of agreement with the Russians. And I'm very skeptical that that is going to be feasible.
Part of the reason Russia is opposed to an anti-ballistic missile shield is due to the need for more nuclear weapons to overwhelm any shield in place. This is so that a nation's nuclear deterrent, which a country would have invested copious amounts of resources into, is still effective. The larger number of nukes one has, the larger and more complex any missile shield would have to be to neutralize one's deterrent. Russia opposes ballistic missile defenses in part because of the cost it would add to the maintenance of their nuclear arsenal. Alistair Millar explains more.
It's also just costly to maintain existing weapons, even if they were to try and cobble together existing materials and extend the shelf life of some of them. They just don't have enough money. And CIA estimates and other intelligence estimates calculate that it's going to be less than 10 years before they fall down to the 1,000 warhead level anyway. So they badly want to reduce nuclear weapons, and they would like to do it in a time frame where the reductions were voluntary, but in conjunction with some comparative reductions on the U.S. side as well. That's what they're talking about in Moscow at the moment. I think they're trying to, you know, if the U.S. are going to push them on trying to build a missile defense and working around or abrogating in tandem the ABM treaty, they want to ensure that the U.S. is going to move down the path to reducing nuclear weapons voluntarily in the same way that Russia is going to do it by necessity.
Jack Mendelson, vice president of the Lawyers Alliance for World Security, describes how he feels the United States should go forward with any proposed anti-ballistic missile system, within the context of the 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty.
administration has been saying, before it came in office and since it came in office, that the ABM treaty must go. It just stands in the way, and it's true, it stands in the way of an experimental or, test program, for, missile defenses of any substantial nature except for those that are based on the ground. If you want to base them at sea, if you want to base them in the air, if you want to base them in space, anything, all of that's ruled out by the treaty. This administration wants to examine those options, and therefore the ABM treaty has got to go. Now, the fact of the matter is, there isn't any hardware available to deploy. Even if we were to say today the treaty is no longer in force, there's nothing we can deploy except systems that are permitted by the treaty, those that are based on the ground. Those that would be based on at sea or in the air or in space, which is even further off, are going to take almost a decade to develop. So there is a sort of a compromise way out, but whether this administration is prepared to examine and accept that way out or not remains a major question, and I think these talks with the Russians right now are really going to examine that. If the administration is dead set on breaking out of the ABM treaty, just abandoning it and having total freedom to go ahead with a missile defense program, then I think we're in for really big trouble. I think the Russians are going to back away from the arms control arrangements that they have with us and all of these major agreements that we've had, the strategic arms reduction agreements and perhaps the comprehensive test ban treaty and maybe the non-proliferation treaty. All these things are going to be in jeopardy. On the other hand, a compromise might be something along the lines of the Russians and the Americans agreeing that a test program can go forward, but that no deployment will take place until the Americans have a proposal that has some boundaries to it, that says to the Russians and to the Chinese, who will be listening very, very closely on this, we Americans have now carried out a decade of tests, and we've decided we need 13 of these, 7 of those, and 4 of these. Can you live with that? But what we're saying right now is, we want to get rid of the ABM treaty, and we want to test and have freedom to do anything. That's not a position, I think, that we can negotiate with the Russians. On the other hand, if we can tell the Russians there's some limits to what we want to do, either now, which we claim we can't do because we don't know what systems we want or how many of them we want to have, but we can tell them, okay, we promise all we're going to do is test, and the deployment issue will come up in a decade, or maybe we'd say we want it to come up in 6 years. But there is no hardware available, so there's absolutely no reason why we actually have to break the entire treaty right now. But we would have to get relief on the clauses in the treaty that do not permit you to test new systems. And then, if we did indeed get that relief, at some point in the future, and it may very well be more than a decade away, if we still want to do this, then we'd have to sit down and talk about deployment. We'd have to show that we have a sort of a program that has some boundaries that other nations can understand so that they can make their own plans against those kinds of deployments. If we're serious in trying to create a new relationship with Russia, then I think we'll be willing to listen to a kind of a compromise. You can test, but not deploy until you have some plan that can show us the limits of these deployments. If we can work something like that, maybe these agreements that we've had in other areas can survive. But if we insist on just collapsing the treaty, going ahead with no constraints, then I think we're in for a lot of problems.
Our European allies have been quite alarmed by the Bush-Cheney administration's rhetoric towards Russia and China since their inauguration. Andrew Kuchins iterates how our allies on the other side of the Atlantic have responded.
It was the concern of particularly our European allies, that led the Bush administration to reach out its hand to Russia and to change its tune on Russia this last spring, realizing that it was important for the administration to at least make a very, very, very strong effort to to work together with the Russians to reach a mutual agreement. On the one hand, to out of concern about the Europeans. The Europeans are a little bit have a different perspective on Russia than we do. I think part of it is geographic. They're much closer to Russia, and if things go things go badly in Russia, then the Europeans are more likely to be affected negatively, whether it be forced migration of economic refugees or ecological catastrophe or et cetera. But it's our European allies that I think pushed us to get together with the Russians to talk about this. On the part of the administration, I think there was also a recognition that it didn't make, with the Chinese spy plane incident nearly coinciding with the spy scandal with Russia, Robert Hansen, and then the mutual expulsion of spies, which sort of signifies the deterioration or the real and potential deterioration of relations with Russia and China. I think there was a realization that, it doesn't make a tremendous amount of strategic sense to alienate the two countries which have the potential to be global competitors and adversaries of the United States simultaneously. In my view, I think it makes sense for the administration to be much more careful and much more forthcoming with both Russia and China, because if we are going to have a more secure world, it's absolutely essential that both Russia and China feel that they have a large investment in the strategic in this new strategic framework, that they not be left out of it.
Much of the attention has been given in the West, especially in the United States, to the possibility of Russia aligning with the People's Republic of China in response to American implementation of an anti-ballistic missile shield. Andrew Kuchins examines this possibility and provides some context.
I think that Russia's relationship with China puts the Russians in a very difficult position, in a very tight strategic box. Because I think on the one hand, the Putin administration would like to reach some kind of compromise agreement with the some kind of deal with the Bush administration that would allow for the deployment of a limited missile defense system, and in return, what would the Russians possibly get? Well, there would be reductions in offensive systems. There would possibly be Russian involvement in the research and development of such a system, and providing components for missile defense systems, and just overall a greater degree of security cooperation between Russia and not only the United States but Russia and the West. Now, at the same time, Russia has an important relationship with China, and as you said, even a limited missile defense system. Let's say the kind of land-based system that the Clinton administration was seeking to move forward with would threaten China's strategic capabilities when they've only got 20 or 25 ICBMs. And the Chinese have been putting a lot of pressure on the Russians not to reach an agreement with the Americans on missile defense. The Russians are deeply ambivalent, in my view, about the longer term relationship with China. The most strategically vulnerable part of the Russian Federation is in the eastern part of the country, the Asiatic part of the country, in the Russian Far East and eastern Siberia, where the demographic trends are running against them. It's very sparsely populated, becoming even more sparsely populated, but it also is a great natural resource treasure trove of the country, and is very important for the long-term viability and prosperity of Russia that these regions remain part of Russia. But Russia shares a long border with China right across the border. There's a burgeoning Chinese population. They see Russia's diminishment in power has been juxtaposed with China's rise in power over the last decade, and this raises a lot of deep-seated anxiety on the part of Russia looking into the longer-term future of its relationship with China. Now, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that the friendship treaty, which you just mentioned, signed between the Russians and the Chinese last month, was for a 20-year duration. The Russians are well aware that 20 years in Chinese history is not a very long period of time, and the Russians' longer-term concerns are about their vulnerability vis-a-vis China. You know, I don't think there's going to be, I'm not predicting any kind of, Sino-Russian war or anything as cataclysmic as that. But this is all to say that the relationship between Russia and China, while there are important near and midterm mutual interests, there are also, on the Russian side, some deep-seated long-term concern about China. So Russia's in a very tough position, kind of trying to balance its interests in becoming more integrated with Europe and strengthening security cooperation with the United States, while at the same time strengthening its relationship with China. Now you'll hear a number of Russian, political circles, analytical circles, sort of the implicit threat or even explicit threat that, if Russia is rejected by the West, then we will turn to China and we will ally with China. I mean, that's not a very realistic option, frankly. It's not something the Chinese are particularly keen on, but it is something that the Russians talk about, and I think it sort of illustrates, in a way, their geostrategic quandary right now. Their interests on missile defense are not exactly coincident. I mean, the Russians are clearly most concerned about the United States' deployment of national missile defense, and not even what the system that would be its effectiveness in 10 years or even 15 years, but probably more long-term than that. And that's because it's 15 to 20 years down the road that one could only imagine possibly that the Russian strategic deterrent could be compromised by deployment of a system.
American insistence on the need for an anti-ballistic missile system has not gone unnoticed by the United States' European allies. Arjun Makhijani, president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, explains.
I think the European Union's response is going to be conditioned very much by the Russian response. Whether there's an agreement between the Bush administration and the Russians on this will be the key. If there's no agreement and the Russians feel that they are left out in the cold at the receiving end of a potential offensive nuclear strategy, then I think the Europeans could well respond by moving closer to the Russians, because they don't want, again, to be threatened by Russian missiles. They don't want to be on the receiving end of any sort of targeting by nuclear weapons on the part of Russia. And I think the U.S. alliance with the European Union could be much weakened. And this, of course, comes in the context of lots of trade and economic tensions with Europe, and the environmental tensions with Europe on the Kyoto Global Warming Treaty. So I think the European response in the absence of an agreement with the Russians could be very serious. If there's an agreement with the Russians and the Chinese don't agree, then I think the situation will be more complicated, and I think probably the European response will not be united.
Alistair Millar analyzes the possible impact of a ballistic missile defense system upon not only Europe, but the NATO alliance and peacekeeping efforts in the region and around the globe.
I think if we look at the relationship with the allies in Europe, if there is enough disquiet among the key allies in NATO, I think many of them will start looking, as they have been over the last couple of years, towards regional security options within Europe that do not involve the United States to such a great extent. And therefore, it will affect the relationship the United States has with its European partners in places like Kosovo and other contingencies where they need to work together. So there may be a problem there. I would say that, as we've seen with other developments, there'll be quite a lot of squawking and disquiet amongst key members of the alliance. But eventually what will happen is it will go forward, I think, but it will put such strains on the alliance as to when there is another conflict or another deployment of forces within NATO that there will be far more disagreement within the ranks, as we saw from the Greeks during the Kosovo conflict. It just gives them more of an excuse to fight against the United States when they really need to be working together.
Even Canada, the nation state that works with the United States at NORAD, and who is quite possibly America's closest ally, is opposed to the United States forging ahead with a ballistic missile defense system. Carl Grossman, a professor of journalism with the State University of New York, explains the Canadian response in the context of international reactions to America weaponizing space.
Our friends, the Canadians, our neighbor, Canada. And Canada has been so concerned about what this big gorilla to the south has been up to in terms of space militarily. I mean, just let me note that in 2000, and also in 1999, there were votes at the United Nations to reaffirm the Outer Space Treaty, and specifically its provision that space be set aside for peaceful purposes. Essentially, the entire world voted yes, 163 nations. And we, the U.S., abstained, both in 99 and 2000. And that was under Clinton. Things are much worse under Bush. In any case, Canada has been seeking, I've been to speeches made by their representative at the United Nations, have been seeking to strengthen the Outer Space Treaty. Now it says there should be no weapons of mass destruction or nuclear weapons in space. Canada wants to have a ban on all weapons in space because the U.S. thinks it can get away with putting lasers up because they're not exactly nuclear weapons. Though actually, there's an issue of how they're going to be energized, with some thinking by the military that we're going to have to energize these lasers and hypervelocity guns and particle beams we want to put up there with nuclear power. But in any case, Canada wants to strengthen the Outer Space Treaty, and it was the vision, and it's worked out for well over 30 years, of the framers of the Outer Space Treaty, keep space for peace. That is the best case scenario, and the Chinese are for this, the Russians are for this. I mean, I sat down with Chinese diplomats at the United Nations, and they say we can do this, forced to do this, but to spend our money, our treasury, our limited wealth for arming the heavens. We have a nation of well over a billion people to feed and to house and to clothe. We do not want to do this, and they're ready. They're more than happy. In fact, they put their own resolutions in at the United Nations to ban all weapons in space, to keep space for peace.
Eugene Carroll, a retired Rear Admiral of the United States Navy, now the Vice President Emeritus of the Center for Defense Information, summarizes the feelings of American allies and asks some poignant questions.
This gets to the attitude of our allies particularly. They see the United States as setting itself apart, isolating itself from the world community, and putting ourselves above the opinions and the interests of our allies. They've told us they don't believe that this is a threat, that we need this system. They know that it will disturb the stability of nuclear relationships around the world and leave them more exposed. So the problem is that it exacerbates the United States' growing tendency to go its own way, independent of the opinion and interests of our friends and allies. This is a very dangerous trend. Are we going to be the world's superpower forever? Are we going to be the world's policeman with 250,000 people stationed around the world forever?
This feature contains segments of interviews with retired United States Navy Rear Admiral Eugene Carroll, now the Vice President Emeritus of the Center for Defense Information. Carl Grossman, a professor of journalism with the State University of New York. Andrew Kuchins, director of the Russian and Eurasian Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Arjun Makajani, president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. Jack Mendelson, vice president of the Lawyers Alliance for World Security. Alistair Millar, Vice President of the Fourth Freedom Forum, and Leon Siegel, Director of the Social Science Research Council's Northeast Asia Security Project. All of the featured interviews were conducted during the last week of July and continued through to the third week of August in the year 2001. This feature contains excerpts from Autechre's track Milk DX from their Peel Sessions EP and Yulquin from their Amber LP. That's it for this program. You've been listening to one part in 10 of the KVSC News feature series, The Defense Pretense, a critical look at proposed missile shields. Reporting for KVSC-FM News, I'm Jed Cousin.